Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
G'day everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and with me today is our usual co-host, Jazz Dana. Jazz, how are you doing in Melbourne?
I'm really good, David. How are you?
Mate, I am fantastic. You know, the weather's cooling down, which is good. You know, we've had a really sticky and hot summer. And thankfully I mean, it's an interesting 2020, I should say, given the fact that it's only February at the moment. We've already seen, a drought to start off with, kick off 2020, and then there's bushfires, and then we've had the turning from one side to the other extreme, from bushfire to flooding in a matter of a few days. That's in near Melbourne. And then we've now got a bit of plague around the place with coronavirus. So, yeah, I don't know about what's waiting for us in 2020. Jazz, what do you reckon?
Yeah, climate change is becoming a bit of a worry, isn't it? It's with the way things are going. One day you get bushfires, the other day there's a thunderstorm. So,
I feel that some people may get a bit distressed with that as well, just because of the uncertainty. And it's only February at the moment. But I thought today we've got a very special guest who's not only just a property investor, but he's also very, very big in terms of physical and mental health. We've got Paul Avril from he's the host of the Man Bits podcast. And he's got such a passion about people's physical and mental health. So it'll be good to obviously get a bit of his insight on his podcast and why he's so passionate about this. But I guess that's first of all, welcome, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, David and Jazz. Thanks for the warm welcome. It's great to be here. For a chat.
Oh, always. Look, I think we don't normally have someone else who's run their podcast coming onto the show as well. So it's always good to have someone who understands the other side of the equation. Let's put it that way.
I'd like to say that, you know, usually when podcasters end up interviewing each other, the technology works out. But as we both know from about 10 minutes ago, that almost didn't happen. But we're here.
That's right. That's what's most important, right? So, So again, welcome. But I guess tell us a little bit about who you are, just so that what is the Man Bits podcast?
Yeah, so it's Paul. Hey guys, great to be on the show. Thanks so much. Look, I'm based in Adelaide with my wife and my 14-month-old daughter. Originally from the UK, I've also got citizenship in New Zealand. I've been on a fair amount of traveling to explore a bit of the world prior to settling a little bit more. And I think it was a couple of years after the earthquake in Christchurch that led us to Adelaide. So we're settled in Adelaide for about 6 years now. And we started building our property portfolio in New Zealand. So where it started, and maybe we can get into that later. Mm-hmm. The podcast, it came out of an idea where I have a training background from way back. So corporate training, sales training, emotional intelligence, leadership development, that kind of thing. And I stepped out of the corporate world into physical health. There's a complete change. I work in remedial massage and saw a lot of guys, mainly majority guys on the table with physical ailments, of course. Women as well, but I was sort of thinking about how guys express themselves in terms of, let's say, declining mental health, or even not just mental health, just stress in general. We're not that good at sharing that stuff. So
that's true.
I felt that there was an opportunity to sort of share the expertise of other people. So I'm sort of a conduit. I'll interview experts in mental health, physical health, lifestyle, general wellness and wealth as well. And I just got interviewing people. We've put out over 100 episodes, and it's super fun. And it's evolved now, actually. I'm now moved it onto YouTube, and I'm sort of gearing it towards fathers. It's called Dad Mastery. So we may see changes with the podcast in terms of the name, but it's all about health, physical health, mental wellness, wealth, and relationships.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm just thinking whether this should be a property podcast or we should discuss about the side
of it. I reckon the questions towards the end will also be very interesting. I can't wait for them, Jazz.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Right. Well, I really do want to dig into the health and fitness side, Paul, but let's go into the property side first. So you have been in the property space for how long?
I'd say started investing seriously 6 years ago. I had done a couple of deals prior to that, but I think that was done very blindly and I wasn't really knowing what I was doing. So I think doing it seriously with a plan and a strategy, that would probably be five or six years ago I started.
What kind of strategy do you follow at the moment? I mean, is it buy and hold or development? What kind of space are you playing in within property?
Buy and hold specifically, more recently high yield, so properties that yield, like standard rental properties that yield over 12 to 15% cash flow, so that's sort of return on investment. Yield actually on the one in the UK is quite significant. And I don't know if you want to get into the numbers, but that one's sitting around 20% yield, but the cash on cash return is around 15%. So higher yield is our focus at the moment. Our first few were standard yielding, positive, all positively cash flowed, it's around 6% yield. And then we ran out of capital. So now we have a bit more of a capital plan.
Right. Okay. What's the current portfolio size?
It's around 2.4 mil.
2.4 mil.
Total value, yeah.
Sure. And what's the total number of properties?
8 properties. Eight across the whole portfolio, yeah.
Yep. And they're mainly based in Adelaide or are you all over?
No, they're all over. So we have them spread over 3 countries. So, yeah, we've got Australia, we have 4. We have two properties and some land in New Zealand, and then we have the HMO over in the UK. HMO is house of multiple occupancy, so multiple tenants in one property, 6-bedroom property with 6 bathrooms, which is the, let's call it the cash cow.
Really, really keen to know more about that one, but let's start with the ones that you have in Australia first. Mm-hmm. So the properties that you have in Australia, what's the total portfolio size of that one?
Let me think. Okay, I can probably throw it together really quickly in my head. I haven't got it in front of me. So I think it's about 1.2, something like that.
1.2, 1.3.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And do you wanna dig into those properties a little bit of where did you start from?
Yeah, absolutely. My actual first property I ever bought, my first serious property was in New Zealand, and that was a 4-bedroom house with a garage on the back, and I ended up renting out all the rooms. So I'd already stepped into the HMO model without even knowing it. But when we sold that after the earthquake, sorry, there's an aeroplane going by. We're on a flight path in North Adelaide here. It's a beautiful spot, but you hear get planes coming over. When we moved to Adelaide, it's probably 2013 or 14, we were still going a bit blind. We didn't really have a real strategy. We weren't specific on our steps to get to that financial freedom goal, which is really where everyone's going. So the first 2 or 3 we bought were standard rentals on a bit of land. And by chance, a couple of them have just been doing really, really well. So they were not what I would say strategized purchases, but there's basically 2 in one of the southern suburbs of Adelaide. It's an area called Heights. It's not the most desirable area, but we've never had an empty property there. We've got a 3-bed and a 2-bed next to each other, and they were previously housing SA houses, which had been renovated. And so there's 2 down there, and then we have a townhouse just on the within the 5K radius of the city in Adelaide, and we have another one a little further out towards the west coast of Adelaide, which is about maybe 7 or 8 Ks from the city centre, and that's another townhouse which we settled on just last year, but it took 2 years to build, and that's one of those new build, not I wouldn't say mistake, but it was certainly a decision I probably wouldn't have made if I'd had a bit more education around it originally. So we've got those 4 here.
What are you specifically looking at when you're making these purchases? Have you been looking for capital growth or more of a rent yield or balanced approach?
our strategy, Giles, has always been positive cash flow. That was always from the very beginning. We all sort of said to ourselves, I don't want to pay out of my own pocket for any of these properties. I want the income to cover the expenses. And that has always been the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've and so those properties were all purchased under that idea. And that was basically by running the numbers and knowing that the numbers worked. So the interesting thing is, though, is we've now come to a level where we've probably about half to three quarters of the way through our property journey, let's say. We can see that now there's a capital growth requirement because our capital is down. Because we've done lots of investing, we've been acquiring for a number of years, and now we're low on capital, so we need to go out and look for capital growth opportunities, and that's where we're at right now. So originally, we look at those properties, specifically at the numbers. House on a bit of land is great, but yielding properties is what we were looking for, positive cash flow.
The ones that you mentioned, the four properties, what sort of cash flow they have been getting in terms of the percent? What kind of rent yield are we talking over here, give or take?
The ones over here in Adelaide?
Yep.
Yeah, they range between 5% and 7% across all four.
5% and 7%. And they have been acquired over the – when did you make these four purchases, the ones that are in Adelaide?
Sure, yeah. The first two were bought in 2014. We bought three in 1 year. We bought three in the first year of 2014, and then the last one settled early last year, so early 2019.
Right, okay. And the ones that you made purchases in 2014, have you seen much growth happen to them in the Adelaide market, or it's mainly been just cash flow positive, essentially?
I would say we haven't really seen much growth. As an aside point, it's always good to look back in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
Making the decision to buy those properties early on, purely on the idea that they would be positively cash flowing properties, is great. And that's what they've done. So they've ticked the box there. But I think if I was sitting in my own shoes 5 years ago, I probably would have looked harder for properties that can do both positive cash flow and capital growth, because I don't think these ones have grown a lot, probably a couple of percent. The ones in the south are next to each other, so the total land there is around 1,400 square meters. So I know that there's a development potential probably in 5 years or so once the highway, because they're building the infrastructure down to that south, the south of the Adelaide city. So there's growth happening, but it's very slow, so it's a long game. And I know that I'll be able to develop on that land later. The two townhouses definitely, even though they're close to the CBD, we don't see a fast growth here. I think it might be another 5 to 10 years before we see any significant growth there.
Let me ask you a question, because your strategy has been positive cash flow, or basically high yielding properties. Did you look at commercial as an option, or any particular reason you went for residential with the positive cash flow?
I just felt comfortable with it, yeah. It's just the area that I feel sort of happy with. I've always been interested in commercial, and I've got friends who invest in commercial. They're a bit more stressed out than me, to be honest, mm-hmm. because they've had a significant amount of vacancy through a period of time and for various reasons. And so for me, I like the idea that I can have somebody in the property most of the year, and I've never had any empty, I haven't really had much vacancy at all across our whole portfolio. So for me, that was sort of a comfort zone thing. And I think it was just about how my risk profile sits at the moment is around the residential space. And same with my wife, Pascal. I mean, I talk about it, me being the investor, it's actually both of us. My wife's the other half of this portfolio.
Yep. No, fair enough. What about the other ones?
Well, the New Zealand, we've got two townhouses in Christchurch, New Zealand. So that's a very interesting setup there, because we bought them post-earthquake. So that would have been after 2011. And they're, again, positively yielding. And they've had, I wouldn't say significant growth, but I think there's probably been about between 7 and 10% growth in the area. But it's a very unknown space, because Christchurch is still rebuilding all these years later. They're still rebuilding in the CBD. And so the properties we have are literally on the outside, just on the outside of the CBD, very close. You can walk into the city from them. And the rents have been very consistent. And I think the growth is there, but it's just Yeah, 7 to 10%, I'd say.
Any particular reason you went to New Zealand to make these purchases?
Well, I've always bought where I lived. That's one thing that, apart from the UK one, that's one thing that some investors sort of fall into that space, but many investors don't at all. But yeah, I've always bought where I lived. So when we bought the townhouses in Christchurch, we were living there at the time, so I knew what was going on the ground. Very interesting, when we first bought one of the ones in Christchurch, actually, no, both of them did this. Just after the earthquake, there was a huge demand for rentals because everybody, or many people, had been displaced from their properties. So rents went through the roof because insurances were covering the rents and so on. But anyway, for the first few weeks of owning that property, we had a bit of a bump in our income because the rents were so high in the area. And then they kind of evened out and balanced. And that was something we didn't foresee after buying them, a post-earthquake. You just don't know what's going to happen when you've been through an earthquake. So that was interesting to see that. And so the reason we bought them is because we were living there and I really wanted to buy properties, and that's the ones we went for. I had another one prior to that. It was a four-bedroom house on one of the four avenues around Christchurch. And I was living there, and I also rented out the sleep out at the back as well. So that was a five-bedroom house. I was living there for free because the rent covered all the costs. And that was the one I really got me on the idea of HMO. But then after the earthquake, it wasn't in a good state. So there was an interesting situation where a lot of investors came to Christchurch to buy property that was listed on the website there as As is where is, which basically means the house is habitable, but it's not insured. Because once the property has been through an earthquake and the insurance is paid out to the owner, and maybe that owner sells that property, then that property cannot be insured under certain situations. So it's a very interesting situation. So I sold that property in an auction to an investor, and he basically put in people in every room, put in tradesmen, because that was the biggest demand at the time. And look, if that property burnt down, and hopefully no one being injured and so on, then that investor would simply just knock it down and rebuild it on the land because it was right next to the CBD. So there's a lot of potential for the investor, and he's just taking a bit of a risk with the actual building of the building's insurance. So long story long, we sold that property and used the funds from that property to buy the other two in Christchurch.
Is it right that in New Zealand you don't have to actually pay a stamp duty?
Correct, yeah, no stamp duty. And although they may have just brought it in capital gains, no capital gains either up until the last check I made. But I think they're starting to bring that in at the moment.
Jeez, so they're bringing capital gains tax too, is it? Just in line with what Australia has.
So this is one of the most attractive things about investing in New Zealand is the no stamp duty, because you can essentially buy property and just keep recycling. If you're investing and you're flipping or however you want to do it, you can just keep recycling because you're not putting a significant amount of your cash down and leaving it on the table. So it's a really attractive deal. We bought some land down near, I don't know how well you know New Zealand, but there's an area in Queenstown, and then there's Wanaka near Queenstown.
I love it.
Yeah, it's beautiful places. Down there. Mm. Yeah, lakes, mountains, it's just lush. And so we have land there, and we bought land a number of years ago. And within 9 months, that land had almost doubled. So we sold it, and we didn't actually want to sell it. There was an instant regret because we bought the land to build on, to move there. We want to live there. But the uplift in the area was so significant that it was silly not to buy it, silly not to sell it. So we sold that, but yeah, no capital gains tax on that sale. So that was a really clean sale, and I think it was about 100K that we pocketed from that deal, which was amazing because it set us up for the next deal. The trouble is we wanted land there. We'd sold it, so we went back and bought land a couple of years later, which we still have now, which we plan on building on later on.
What was the reason that the land price doubled in such a short period of time, especially in South Island? Because as far as I know, I think they jokingly said there's more sheep in South Island than the population there. Isn't that correct?
That old chestnut, yeah. The reason that it doubled, I'm speculating a little bit, but this is, I think this is pretty accurate. Queenstown is a tourist hub.
Yes.
It's also very attractive for couple of different types of people. You get your sort of CEO types who are popping out the top of their businesses and they want to retire somewhere beautiful, or they want to have a holiday home. So they'll buy in and around Queenstown. Mm. So that pushed the property prices really high, a lot of external investment. And there was also a huge demand for rentals because it's a massive tourist hub. So you get a lot of people renting property and there was too many people. So some properties I heard were, you know, there's 10 plus people renting out a 3 or 4 bedroom house.
Wow.
And they'd change shifts. One would go to work in the morning and the other person would come home from work and jump in the bed. And then that person would get home and they'd swap over because there was just no space. It was absolutely saturated. Terrible situation for renters. So there was a huge growth in Queenstown. This is much like the Melbourne-Sydney growth. It kind of bleeds out. So Queenstown was saturated and growing. Wanaka felt a lot of that as well because Wanaka is smaller than Queenstown, but it's still a beautiful place and it's very popular.
Yep.
So that started growing as well. And then the small, literally small village that we bought land in, the farmland is being split down into subdivisions and they're now starting to split up the land to sell off for development. So there's been a few developments in that small village. So we just saw huge growth. We just basically saw it happening. And the first one, as I mentioned earlier, that we sold, we saw that that happened. And then this second one we went to buy, and already within the last year, that's already probably gone up about 80K. This property's selling up there now for almost 100K more than what we bought it for. This is land, sorry, not property.
Yeah, yeah, right. Wow. And and when did you bought into the Wanaka or around the first block of land that in South Island? Which year was that?
That purchase would have been 2016, I think.
16, okay.
15 or 16.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, so after the Sydney and Melbourne, the first run of the Sydney and Melbourne boom, essentially at that point, it took a bit of dip, and that's when the South Island in New Zealand also started to.
Well, I think the South Island would have probably felt some of that growth from Auckland as well, because Auckland went through a very similar growth boom. So, yeah, it's a number of factors I think that contributed to the growth. I say we got lucky.
You make your luck, mate.
Good timing in, that's for sure. So, also with the Christchurch purchase back in 2011, I want to touch on the psychology of that a little bit. So after the earthquake, most of the time people are thinking, oh, this is not safe. I shouldn't be buying. So I was kind of thinking, if I was you in that time, and this is just being an investor, it's a great time to pick up properties because people will be selling, I'm assuming. So has there been a drop or massive drop in terms of the property prices after the earthquake in Christchurch?
Oh, no, there's not been a massive drop, but they've certainly leveled out. So you're right. I mean, it's a devastating situation. I was there when it happened. It was awful. Off the back of it, and off the back of any economic disaster, is opportunity, and it's just the way it is. And so that property I mentioned that I sold, that one was kind of like my stepping stone out of one market into another, because I was renting out all the rooms and I wanted to actually grow my portfolio, but I was sitting on this essentially cash cow. So it worked really well for us then. I forgot the question. Sorry, David.
That's okay. But I guess the question was, I think you've answered it in a way, because has there been significant price reduction after the earthquake? In other words, did you pick up way below market value in terms of the intrinsic value of the properties at that time?
Well, this is interesting as well, because at the time, if you go on to trademe.co.nz, which is essentially the realestate.com.au equivalent, you would go on there after the earthquake, and any property selling on that platform would not have a price. So nobody knew what to pay or what to buy for. Even the agents didn't know. So they'd all be listed either as is where is, which is those ones I mentioned that didn't have insurance, or what was the word they used? Usually you just use either price on application or negotiable. Nobody knew.
Contact agent, that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, that's it. It's really vague. And really, they were just guessing as to what property might be worth. And what really changes things is the demand for rentals. I think anybody who stepped into the market in Christchurch just after the earthquake probably did okay, but there are a number of factors to consider because the land had changed. There's different categories for the land, TC 1, 2, and 3, which is about the quality of that land. So some property, you may have owned it for 20 years and it's been a solid property, and then the earthquake happens and suddenly the soil underneath is worthless. There's whole suburbs that have had to be relocated because the soil is not good enough to build on anymore.
Wow.
So there's huge risk because there was a lot of uncertainty about that land as well. So there was a lot of time to be taken, engineer reports to be had before you even buy property there. So it's an opportunity, but it was an opportunity that takes a lot of work and a little bit more risk.
Yeah, right. Okay. No, it's great insight, I guess. And I guess, you know, like for all the investors who's wishing to capitalize on opportunities like this, you know, certainly there still need to be detailed due diligence. It's not like you can just buy blind. You know, they say like throw a dart somewhere in Christchurch back in 2011, you make money. Not really. It doesn't always work that way. Yeah, you do need to carry out thorough due diligence as well, even especially in particular the time like these where there's opportunities to be capitalized on. So
one thing to add, David.
Yeah, sure.
Is no matter what the economic situation, I see opportunity everywhere. Even if there's a boom, there's opportunity. So I think sometimes we sort of want to wait until a certain event happens, like let's say there's a drop in the market or cash, you know, maybe there's a global financial crisis, let's say.
Like coronavirus at the moment.
Coronavirus, you know. Mm-hmm. Let's wait until an event happens and then jump in the market. I think if you're not jumping in the market because you're waiting for something external to happen before doing it, then you need to take action, because I think there's always a good time to get into the market. There's always an opportunity out there. You just got to find it.
Yeah, sage advice there, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, that's good. What about the, I forgot what year did we had the earthquake, the massive earthquake?
So they had two. They had one in the December of 2010 that was significant, but not as devastating as the 2011. That was February 2011.
Did that change the sentiment, Paul, for people who were purchasing properties there, whether they were first homeowners or investors, or...
Honestly, Jazz, I think people are still trying to get over it. It's a 20, 30-year recovery, I think, with those kind of events. Not just this is stepping into the mental health side of things, but not just for the mental health side of things. You know, it's traumatic to go through it, but also the feeling of safety, the feeling of the risk profile for people would have changed, I would say. A lot of people just left Christchurch and won't come back. Some people stuck it through and stayed, and they're the ones, you know, who may be capitalizing on this new market that we're in. It's a completely new market, so I think the sentiment's changed in that initially it was complete uncertainty, and now people are starting to see a bit of growth. The city is growing and it's being rebuilt. There's a lot of new buildings through the center, and that's just bleeding out into the rest of the suburbs. So it's coming on again. It's coming along and it's building again. I think Christchurch is the biggest city in the South Island of New Zealand, and it's going to be a wonderful city again. It's always been a wonderful city. It's a great place, albeit occasionally a bit shaky.
So that's Christchurch. Let's move on to where are the other properties? Do you have more in New Zealand?
We have the two in Christchurch, and then we have the land down in the south near Wanaka.
That's interesting. So you're holding onto a block of land. Obviously, that's not giving you any return.
No.
Where does that fit within your portfolio? Because you have been building so far positive cash flow portfolio. So where does that fit in?
That land is where we're going to live. So eventually, whilst we acquire and build right now, in about 3 years, we'll move over to that town. But the reason we are comfortable with holding it without return is that the portfolio itself is supporting that. So we don't pay for that. It's coming out of the positive cash flow. And this is, I think, it's interesting because a lot of people jump in to the, let's call it, negative gearing setup first. They get big growth with a lot of negatively geared properties and a lot of capital growth. But there's obviously top-up that's required there. We've sort of done it backwards in that we've got the positive cash flow, which now covers those negatively geared or land purchases.
Okay. Any other countries that you've targeted?
Yeah, well, the UK is our other one. And actually, the UK is going to be our focus for the next two or three buy and hold properties, because those, that is a particular model. That is the HMO model that I mentioned earlier on.
Yep.
That's house of multiple occupancy, because it's high cash flow. And that's what we, ultimately, our goal is within 5 years, both Pascal and I won't have to work. We will work because we love work, but we won't have to work for anyone or any reason. And it's those properties which will bring that cash flow, which covers our expenses. I always find it interesting when people talk about, you know, financial freedom. When you've got social media showing us all the wonderful, amazing things that, and amazing lives that people lead, we build up a picture in our minds that financial freedom looks like fast cars, huge house, pool, and all this wonderful stuff. And that's fine. That's what you want. What's that?
Sorry, all the glossy, all the fancy, yeah, and all the glossy stuff. Yeah.
Yep. The glossy stuff. And that's great. That's awesome. But actually, for us, I don't need all of that. If I want to drive a fast car, I'll go and hire one for a weekend. And, I'm not too fussed about it. But my point is that financial freedom just means your expenses are covered. And anything you have over the top of that is a bonus. So financial security, financial freedom, they're not actually as far away as we think. They're quite attainable. And for us, it's just two or three of the high-yielding properties which will get us to that point.
Sure. So what's the yield that you're getting in the UK currently for the properties that you have?
We've got one there, and it's yielding 22% a year.
22%.
Is that net or gross?
That's gross yield. So cash flow return on investment is between 15 and 17%. And that's on a really bad interest rate.
Like what kind of interest rate are you getting there?
We're on 7.29 there on that one. Because,
wow. Okay.
7.29.
Interest only?
Well, we always talk about the mistakes we made when we – depends how much time we've got, but I could go into the kind of the complexities of getting the lending over there. It took a while to get the lending sorted. And part of that was, it was 2 a.m. when we received an email from the UK saying your lending has been approved. And we're like, woohoo. And I had to send it back very quickly because we were on a time frame. So we sent it back at 2 a.m. and forgot to read the detail, which was that it was a principal and interest loan. We wouldn't have done it otherwise, but it's on principal and interest. So it's yielding very highly and it's cash flowing very well, even though it's also paying principal. Yeah.
That's awesome. Can I make a suggestion, Jazz? I think I'm mindful, I'm cautious of the time. And I think, you know, the UK journey and also the HMO is going to take, I mean, we can easily talk at least half an hour out of it. Can I suggest we leave that as part two? Because you've already covered a really decent chunk of your journey so far, especially the Christchurch story. I think that's a lot of information for the listeners to take already out of the last 30 minutes. So my suggestion is, let's put a pause on the current today's episode, and basically we'll get you back in a couple of weeks and then we'll finish off the second part. How does everyone think?
Definitely. No, that's good. That's a good call. I agree with that. Yeah. Paul, now... Changing gears a little bit, we do want to discuss your UK journey as well. That is going to take a little bit more time, and it's going to be a chapter in itself. So we'll probably have to bring you back. Yeah, we'll probably have to bring you back on the show at some point to discuss that too. But pretty excited to discuss that. However, moving away from property, asking you a couple more different questions, just something different. Aliens, believer or not?
God, that is outside the box, isn't it? Believe it when I see it. That's what I'll say to that.
All right. So at this point, you haven't seen one, so you don't believe in them.
Exactly.
No, fair enough. How about crypto? Is it here to stay or a fad?
Ah, interesting. The technology is here to stay.
But none of the existing currencies, cryptocurrencies, are.
Well, some might be. I mean, I've got some crypto, and I'm just sitting on it. But, I believe in the technology. I believe it's going to completely disrupt the way we do anything in terms of business and communication and contracts. Everything is going to change through crypto, through blockchain. Some of those currencies are definitely fads. the marijuana currency, for example, the cannabis currency.
Yeah. When you say it's going to change completely the way we operate, give us a little bit more on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not a crypto expert. I'm a speculator because there's you know, who knows at the end of the day. But I think what I know of it, what I know of the blockchain technology, is that it's a trustless system. Every transaction, every level of communication is captured in the blockchain. And look, you can Google it for more information. It's not going to spend too much time on that. But the way that we communicate, let's say you're buying a property, we won't need traditional banking for that. The transaction can happen between the vendor and the buyer directly. There may even not be a need for the agent, but actually I think because humans are human, there'll always be a need for an intermediary and these kind of things. But I think that a lot of the processes and the red tape and the boxes that need to be ticked in terms of going through a pathway of, say, a property purchase, for example, will be mitigated because the blockchain will allow for a more direct communication line and a more trust-based communication line.
Right, okay. But do you think it will replace the existing financial system?
If the existing, again, not an expert, but if the existing big banks and those big banks do not get on board, they will be hugely disrupted. Yeah.
Interesting. Now that's cool. Negative interest rates, do you think we'll see them anytime in the near future in Australia?
Well, we've seen some in Europe. And look, I mean, some of the negative interest rates, that's on the base rates. It's not necessarily going to reach the actual consumer, but potentially the banks might end up there, and then they'll create something in their package to make up the difference. But potentially it could come here. We are getting to that point, and the economy is in a very interesting and unique place right now. And not being an economist, I couldn't sort of tell you details and specifics, but I think that looking at what's happening overseas, potentially it could reach our shores. But I don't think it'll be any time in the immediate future.
Driverless cars. Do you think that will soon, in the next 5 to 10 years, see majority of the cars on the road being driverless, or it's going to take longer than that, or that's not going to happen?
I would love to see that. I think the next 5 years we'll absolutely see some. I don't think the majority, though. I think possibly 5 to 10 years, majority of vehicles will be electric or near to that. So that would be great to see. But definitely 10 years, I'd say, would be there. I think there's certain goals been set for that. Driverless, not too sure. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see that.
Yeah, cool.
Hope so. I'd get so much more done in a day.
Yeah, think about it. Sitting in a car, you don't have to drive. You actually are working. That means a lot more productivity, but a lot more work as well for humans to do.
That's right.
That's good. That's all the questions that I had. Look, it was great to have you on the show discussing your journey. I think you've built a decent cash flow positive portfolio that is sustaining itself and also paying for a land, which is pretty awesome. So there is the UK journey that we want to discuss, HMO, but that will be probably next time because we're going to run out of time discussing that. But thanks for coming on the show, Paul. To our listeners, hope they are enjoying the content. And if you are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let the word spread like a fire. Spark your fire. Cheers, Jez and David. Bye.
Bye. If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.